Welcome to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm your host, Carl Morand. Today I'm speaking with Jason Brownlee, author of the book Democracy Prevention: The Politics of the U.S.-Egyptian Alliance. From the signing of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty up to the present, Brownlee describes the four areas in which the U.S. strengthened Egyptian leaders: national defense, coup-proofing, macroeconomic stability, and domestic repression. The book outlines the evolving relationship between Washington and Cairo, from Cold War efforts against the Soviet Union to working with Egypt in the fight against Islamic terrorism. Brownlee explains how repeated U.S. rhetoric of spreading democracy and human rights did not always match its actions, and how strategic interests almost always trumped idealistic goals, both in the past and potentially in the future. Jason, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. If you could you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself and what led you to write this book?
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for having me on the podcast. I have been visiting Egypt and studying it for really since the mid-1990s when I went there when I was in college. And I've now spent several years in Egypt over the course of many trips. And one of the things that struck me really back in the 1990s was just how authoritarian the regime of Hosni Mubarak was. For a while, there had been hopes that because there were elections and a multi-party system in Egypt, that the country would gradually become more democratic. And by the end of the 1990s, it was clear that Hosni Mubarak was not taking the country in that direction. So I wrote a book, my first book, it's called Authoritarianism in an Age of Democratization, to grapple with this problem of how authoritarian regimes would reproduce themselves while holding elections, while allowing some amount of political party competition. And after that book came out, I continued to go to Egypt. I was following the opposition to Mubarak, the dissidents and the activists who were organizing, and this is around 2008, 2009, kind of the seeds of the opposition that would really come onto the scene in 2011. And I was reading the literature that dissidents were producing under Mubarak, and I was curious to understand really what were their main goals. And one of the things that struck me was that they weren't only concerned about Hosni Mubarak's domestic behavior, his repression, his use of the emergency law, which is basically a kind of martial law system. They were also concerned about his foreign policy, about his relationship with the United States, and about how he used Egypt's power and influence in the Middle East. And the more I read, the more I saw that these activists and dissident writers, many of whom were on the left wing of the spectrum, some of whom had more of an Islamist orientation, they were very troubled by the U.S.-Egyptian relationship. And they saw the United States as playing a role in the reproduction of authoritarianism in Egypt. This is something that I had not looked at much in my first book, and I realized that it needed more attention. We have a lot of discussions and a lot of studies about American democracy promotion. For example, when people talk about Ukraine or Georgia, these countries that had electoral revolutions in the early 2000s in which the U.S. was rooting for the underdog and maybe contributed to the defeat of autocratic rulers. We don't have much work, at least not much really careful research, on the U.S. role in the other side of that equation. When the U.S. supports authoritarian rulers in the Middle East and in other regions. And so what I wanted to do in this book, Democracy Prevention, The Politics of the U.S.-Egyptian Alliance, is show the way the U.S. has participated in the reproduction of authoritarianism in Egypt for nearly 40 years. And it's an open question about whether that role is going to change now that Hosni Mubarak has been overthrown. But I think, and I hope, the book provides readers a solid background for understanding what Washington and Cairo have been doing over many decades and why that is such a major concern for the activists and the young democratic forces in Egypt.
You mentioned in the introduction that during the 32 years from the signing of the Egyptian-Israeli Treaty up until the January Revolution, that the United States has strengthened local incumbents in four respects: national defense, coup-proofing, macroeconomic stability, and domestic repression. Could you talk about sort of why you view those as the four main areas of influence that the U.S. has had on Egyptian politics?
Yes, absolutely. So when people look at the U.S.-Egyptian relationship, one thing they naturally focus upon is the tremendous levels of military and economic aid that have gone from Washington to Cairo over the years. At this point, it's about $60 billion, billion with a B, $60 billion over the past 40 years, basically, but mainly after 1979 with the signing of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty and the beginning of the current U.S. aid, military aid package to Egypt, which stabilized around $1.3 billion in the 1980s, and that's the level where it remains. So it's one thing, though, to look at these dollar amounts and see how much aid is going to Egypt. And it's another to say that this aid or this relationship is actually helping Hosni Mubarak, or before him Sadat, actually helping them to maintain their regime. After all, if we think about Iran during the 1970s, that is Iran before the Iranian Revolution, the U.S. was giving or selling to Iran a tremendous amount of weaponry, and it didn't keep the Shah in power. So what I wanted to do is think about the mechanisms through which the U.S. relationship with Egypt actually helps to sustain authoritarianism. And I thought about them in terms of the threats and the challenges that autocratic rulers face. The most common challenge and the most common way for an autocrat to be overthrown is actually not through revolution. It's not through foreign invasion. It's through military coups. The military tends to be the most cohesive political organization in a country. It can act on very short notice, and since it's so close to the top of government, it can be very effective at removing the ruler. The Egyptian regime that Hosni Mubarak was ruling was founded by a military coup in 1952, and all of Egypt's presidents have been aware that the military could act against them. So one of the most important ways in which the U.S. relationship with Egypt has helped to maintain authoritarianism is through coup-proofing, basically preventing reducing the likelihood that the military is going to execute a kind of hostile takeover of the government. And military aid and weapon sales are a great way to do that. So it's not just the $1.3 billion, the sheer amount of military aid going to Egypt. It's the access that Egyptian generals get to American technology, American expertise. And this helps to keep the Egyptian military aligned with U.S. interests. So that's the coup-proofing aspect. If we look at other mechanisms in which the U.S. has helped to sustain authoritarian regimes in Egypt, another would be macroeconomic stability, basically economic bailouts. So it's not so much that the U.S. gives a few hundred million dollars of economic aid each year. I think actually the benefit for the Egyptian economy is negligible, and some Egyptian economists would say it's actually had a negative effect on the Egyptian economy by increasing Egypt's reliance on the United States. But what has happened is that whenever Egypt gets close to having a serious economic crisis with that could provoke large-scale rioting and social unrest, the U.S. and other Western economies have worked to prevent that crisis and bail out the Egyptian economy. And the fear in their minds, the fear in the minds of people in Washington, D.C., is that there could be a repeat of 1977. Now, what happened in January of 1977 in Egypt was that President Anwar Sadat had been told that he needed to cut subsidies for some basic commodities that Egyptians consumed, things like cooking oil and sugar. And when the subsidy cuts were announced as a way for Sadat to try to balance his budget, there was massive rioting across Egypt for 2 days, and it was only suppressed by the Egyptian army. So that's how Sadat regained control, was through deploying the military. So in subsequent decades, the United States and other Western countries have been keen to avoid a repeat of these 1977 price riots, and they have helped to boost the Egyptian economy through periodic debt relief when needed. So that's another mechanism. And then the last mechanism, well, there's also external defense, which I can just mention briefly. One way that authoritarian regimes can be overthrown is if other countries invade them and topple them. And that's something that authoritarian rulers have to think about. One way that you can help to preserve an authoritarian regime and free up some of its resources is to basically guarantee that its territorial security is not going to be threatened. And that's something that the U.S. has done for Egypt, basically by having such a prominent military alliance. There is little risk that a neighboring country, let's say Libya, under Muammar Gaddafi, was going to militarily attack Egypt. The last mechanism that I talk about, it may be surprising that it comes in last, is domestic repression. And again, if we think about the Shah of Iran in the 1970s, the U.S. supplied weapons, supplied all kinds of military hardware, and the Shah was very repressive internally. He had a massive internal security police force that jailed people, tortured people, killed them, brutalized them. So repression is certainly going on, and you do have American weapon sales to these very repressive states. But I would argue that actually the weapon sales are more important for military relations between the two governments than they are for domestic repression, simply because if you look at what the police are using, whether it was in Iran in the 1970s or in Egypt under Hosni Mubarak, the police are not, in terms of daily repression, they're not relying on advanced technology. They're not relying on heavy military hardware. Tanks are only used in crisis situations like the price riots of 1977. They're not being used on a daily basis. Same thing for fighter jets, or you can go even further. Think about submarines or naval vessels that the U.S. might sell to countries. So the $1.3 billion that the U.S. is granting Egypt each year in military aid is mainly to purchase these heavy-duty, very expensive, big-ticket items like jets and tanks. It's not to purchase tear gas canisters or truncheons or police gear or crowd control equipment. So in that sense, the relationship is not so much about domestic repression, which most of the time the government is very capable of carrying out on even a limited budget. And you can see that all around the world. Of course, you can have some very, very poor, impoverished countries with authoritarian regimes that engage in massive and very violent repression. So, but it is a mechanism. It is a way in which the U.S. has played a role in the reproduction of authoritarianism in Egypt, is through supply equipment, which can be.
You talk about the Sadat and Carter relationship. Do you think you mentioned that for Carter's administration, they viewed human rights as something they'd have to balance with other foreign policy objectives? And at the end of a quote from that administration, you say that human rights would be defended when not superseded by other foreign policy goals. Do you think they considered human rights as sort of bottom of the list of priorities for foreign policy goals? And do you think they potentially saw any benefits to advocating foreign policy? Do you think they considered that, okay, you know, pursuing human rights in another country will have benefits beyond just obtaining human rights for those people?
The Carter administration is remembered as the human rights administration. Carter gave speeches where he talked about human rights, and there are some who look back on his presidency and think, well, this is a president who really put human rights at the top of the list in a way that other presidents didn't. And it's true that in some areas, such as Carter's policy toward South Africa, toward apartheid South Africa, that Carter was ahead of his time and behaved more was a stronger advocate for human rights and equality than other presidents. But in general, the pattern with Carter, as with other occupants of the Oval Office, was that strategic and economic interests came first, and human rights considerations of how foreign governments treated their own people came second. And I mean, the way to think about this when it comes to Egypt is, how did Carter and his administration think about the very brutal and ongoing treatment of Egyptian opposition forces by Egyptian President Anwar Sadat? So Carter comes into office January 20th, 1977, right after the price riots had occurred. So at a moment of acute instability in Egypt. And one of his priorities is Egyptian-Israeli peace, which he pursues to great success over the next 2 years. But while Carter is pursuing peace, Sadat is repressing his own people. And Carter is aware of this, but he does not put human rights in Egypt at the top of his list. Instead, he focuses on getting an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty for the strategic reason that bringing Egypt to peace with Israel will help to push back against what the White House perceived as Soviet influence in the Middle East. So this was a strategically driven campaign for bilateral peace between Egypt and Israel. And human rights within Egypt did not enter into the calculations in any significant degree. In fact, when it came time to make tough compromises and close the deal at Camp David in 1978, when Carter brought together Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, when it came time to make tough compromises, Carter counted on Sadat's ability to enforce his will, to enforce what he wanted on the Egyptian people, rather than responding to the Egyptian people. It was understood, and I discussed this at some length in the book, it was understood by Begin and Carter that they had domestic constituencies they had to respond to. They had elections coming up that they had to think about. Sadat didn't have those. He wasn't going to face a serious election. His parliament was stacked with cronies from his party. So they thought, Begin and Carter thought, well, Sadat can make the compromises. You know, Begin doesn't have to make the compromises. It'll be Sadat who concedes and accepts what is necessary for this peace treaty. And that meant retreating from positions that he had taken that would have been popular among Egyptians and many more outside of Egypt. It meant retreating on the goal for a broader Arab-Israeli peace, not just an Egyptian-Israeli peace. It meant retreating from the goal of meaningful autonomy for the Palestinians in the West Bank. And it meant basically ending up with a bilateral peace treaty, a separate peace between Egypt and Israel that would leave the peace process in limbo for decades afterward. And so not only was Carter not prioritizing human rights in Egypt, he was actually prioritizing, he and his national security team were prioritizing and taking advantage of the fact that Egypt had a very authoritarian ruler. And they empowered that ruler, they relied on that ruler to make the peace treaty happen, and they expected him to stay in power for years afterward. So he was their partner. Another way of approaching it, a very different way of approaching it that would have put human rights first, would have been to think about a peace treaty that would have been broadly accepted by the Egyptian people, and to encourage Sadat to, or allow Sadat and his advisors, whom Carter ignored, to allow Sadat and his advisors to put that type of program forward. And instead, they did the exact opposite. They came up with a peace treaty that would be acceptable to Menachem Begin's government, and they expected Sadat to impose it.
Could you talk about the 1991 Algerian election and the implications it had with Islamists being elected, and particularly the fear of the one man, one vote, one time scenario as it related to U.S.-Egyptian relations?
Yes, this was a crucial episode in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East after the end of the Cold War. So the Cold War ends in 1989, and the U.S. basically it doesn't have a superpower rival or a major strategic rival in the region. At the end of 1991, the Soviet Union even dissolved. Well, right as the Soviet Union dissolved, Algeria had parliamentary elections. So the country of Algeria, this is in the middle of North Africa, next to between Libya and Morocco. Algeria had parliamentary elections, which were competitive. They were meaningful elections. And an Islamic opposition party, known as the Islamic Salvation Front, did very well in the first round of elections. There was going to be a runoff. It was expected that in the runoff, they would win a majority and they would control the parliament in Algeria. Well, the Algerian military decided to intervene and preempt the runoff so that the elections would not be concluded. And the result for Algeria was a decade-long civil war in which hundreds of thousands of people perished. So that was the beginning of a very, very a tragic chapter in Algerian history. Well, for the United States and for the George H.W. Bush administration, which was on the one hand enjoying its unipolar world that was made possible by the end of the Cold War and the dissolve of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, was on the other hand also thinking about a new strategic threat or what other actors might challenge American primacy. And the first Bush administration expressed a deep fear about Islamic movements like the Islamic Salvation Front taking power. And the way that Secretary of State Jim Baker's assistant put it was, the United States will not accept a situation of one man, one vote, one time. Now, what he meant by that was, and the narrative that the U.S. officials gave, was that if Islamists like the Islamic Salvation Front were elected and allowed to govern, they would then stop holding any future elections. So it, instead of just being kind of one man, one vote, the idea of basic idea of suffrage, universal suffrage, it would be one man, one vote, one time. So essentially one free and fair election, but then no more after that. And there would be a new Islamist dictatorship established. And that fear of Islamists taking power has continued to shape U.S. foreign policy. And in fact, it's only now really with the Obama administration's relationship with Egypt that and Tunisia in the wake of the Arab uprisings that we're beginning to see some evolution beyond that mindset. But as late as 2008, when Obama was running for office, members of his national security team would say, when it comes to Egypt, we can't accept a situation of one man, one vote, one time. They would essentially pick up the exact same line, the same mantra that was being said by the George H.W. Bush administration nearly 20 years prior. And what I say in the book is that really this supposed fear of Islamist governments taking over and imposing dictatorship is disingenuous. Because if you look at U.S. relations around the region, the U.S. policy does not reflect a principled opposition to authoritarianism or to conservative Islamic rule. So just to think about authoritarianism, for instance, the U.S. has all kinds of alliances with authoritarian regimes inside the Middle East and beyond the Middle East. So, you know, whether it's the Islamic Salvation Front that takes over and cuts off elections, if they were actually going to do that, which we'll never know, or if it's a secular ruler who cuts off elections or holds phony elections like Sadat or like the Algerian junta that took over, you know, it's still authoritarianism. So there's no kind of basis on which to say the U.S. opposes the curtailing of elections or opposes the holding of fraudulent elections. At the same time, if you think about, well, maybe it's something about Islamists taking over or having a more traditional religious government. Well, the U.S. has great relations with Saudi Arabia, which is about the most traditional Islamic government that you can have. So, I mean, very, very kind of hardcore fundamentalist government in terms of the relationship between doctrine and actual legal practices. So these, I say in the book that these arguments don't really stand up to scrutiny. And instead, what the U.S. is worried about when it's thinking about opposition movements coming to power, whether in Algeria or in Egypt or in the Palestinian Authority, is not a change in domestic practices, not about authoritarianism domestically or about conservative Islamic policies domestically. It's about foreign policy. It's about governments being more independent from the United States, more willing to go their own way, more willing to assert themselves and disagree with the United States. And I cite the example of Turkey under the AKP, which has been in power since 2003. So the AKP in Turkey is an Islamist party, but it's Western oriented, it's moderate. Yet it is willing to, and has on occasion, disagreed with the United States. I mean, Turkey is a NATO ally, it's a key partner of the United States. But, you know, let's say 10% of the time, Ankara and Washington have disagree. You know, it's normal among allies. It's normal among sovereign countries to have disagreements. Well, that 10% disagreement is 10% more than the U.S. ever had with Hosni Mubarak or with Anwar Sadat. So the fear about Islamist governments or any type of opposition government, not just Islamist government, not just Islamist opposition, the fear of opposition movements taking power is really based upon a fear of governments being more independent. An Algerian government that's more independent, a Palestinian government, let's say, that's more independent, or an Egyptian government that's more independent. And so while this mantra of one man, one vote, one time has circulated for two decades and has seemed to be the driving principle for U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, I argue that really there are other motives underneath this which relate to the U.S. fear to accept other governments pursuing a foreign policy that's independent of what the United States wants. And here we come back to the voices of opposition in Egypt, which I mentioned at the very opening of the podcast, that Egyptians, say Egyptian activists, whether they're leftists or Islamists or right-wing, they have an idea that they want their country to pursue a foreign policy that serves Egyptians, not one that serves, you know, whatever people in Washington want, which is what they feel has been happening. And there's great evidence that it has been happening under Mubarak and under Sadat. So it's this idea of having an Egyptian foreign policy that reflects what Egyptians want, not an Egyptian foreign policy that's run by a single autocrat and reflects what that autocrat's partners in Washington want.
You quote Mubarak in 1999 when he was receiving an honorary degree at George Washington University, and he says, "The road to democracy is a long one, and we travel it with confidence." Do you think comments like those from Mubarak were taken seriously inside of Egypt or inside the U.S. administration?
That honorary address was interesting for me to learn of. I hadn't heard of it, but I was interviewing the U.S. ambassador to Egypt at the time, Daniel Kurser, and he brought it up. And what he and other ambassadors whom I interviewed for the book told me is what they would try to do is, if Mubarak talked about democracy, or if the Egyptian government had laid out some policy regarding democracy, they would invoke that language from time to time to say, "Well, look, this is what you talked about. Why don't you, you know, hold yourself to this standard that you set out?" So I don't think it was taken. I don't think it was taken very seriously by Egyptians. I think it was only taken seriously by U.S. foreign policymakers to the extent that they could kind of use it in their conversations with Mubarak to get a little bit of leverage over him. Often, by the way, for other matters, strategic matters, not for matters of democracy within Egypt. And I would say one way to interpret the speech by Mubarak is to just compare the rhetoric with the reality. I mean, to compare what he was saying with what he was doing. In 1999, Mubarak was, you know, elected, we'll put that in scare quotes, elected for a fourth 6-year term. And at that point, he had ruled longer than any of his predecessors, longer than President Gamal Abdel Nasser, longer than Sadat. And he was really at that point becoming what looked like a president for life. And if it hadn't been for the Egyptian uprising in 2011, I have no doubt that he probably would have continued ruling until close to the end of his days. There was no indication that he was going to voluntarily step aside in the context of a free and fair election where the opposition could win. So I would say, yeah, take the rhetoric, look at it, but then look at the behaviors and see whether they line up. We can do that with Mubarak speeches. We can do that with the speeches of U.S. leaders as well, which I do when discussing the so-called freedom agenda of George W. Bush. You know, we had the speeches where George W. Bush called on Egypt to lead the Middle East toward democracy, and then we have the behaviors of the George W. Bush administration, which involved continuing to give military aid to Egypt, cooperating with Mubarak on extraordinary rendition, cooperating with him so that Mubarak would assist the U.S. in prosecuting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So basically, all kinds of intelligence and security cooperation at a time where publicly Bush was calling on Mubarak to be more democratic.
You mentioned George W. Bush and his freedom agenda, which you address at length in the book. Could you talk about the two groups within the administration that you describe as one being for democracy promotion and the other being for diplomacy promotion?
Okay, so what I found in looking at the U.S.-Egyptian relationship is that when it comes to democracy, I mean, those who invoke democracy, whether it's members of Congress or members of the National Security Council, when they're talking about democracy in Egypt, they're mainly invoking it as a way of getting leverage over the Egyptian government so that the government can cooperate more on strategic matters and regional security matters. And specifically, when it comes to Egypt, the main issue of concern is Israeli security, and related to that, security around the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula. So there were these two groups in the George W. Bush administration, which differed about democracy promotion. Mainly, they differed about the extent to which democracy should be kind of raised as a way of getting leverage over the Egyptian regime. One of them, the group that you might think of as diplomacy promoters, was based mainly in the State Department, also to some extent in the Pentagon and in the intelligence, in the CIA and the intelligence agencies. And these were, for the most part, career civil servants, many of whom had served in the Foreign Service and had spent time in the Middle East. They had an understanding for Egypt. They had an understanding for Egypt's relations with other relationships with other countries, including with Israel. And they had a sense for public opinion in Egypt. And they were interested, they were more interested in making progress on the Israel-Palestine conflict and generally maintaining strong or improving U.S. relations with other Arab countries than they were with kind of pressuring Mubarak. Now, the other group, the sort of democracy promotion crowd, tended to be from the neoconservative wing of the American political spectrum. They were very concerned about Israeli security, and they wanted Mubarak to do more to improve Israeli security and to improve Israel's presence in the region and power in the region. And so this group, which was not so concerned about domestic public opinion in Egypt, not so concerned about how Arabs in general perceived the United States, was interested in putting pressure on Mubarak so that he would do more to cooperate with the United States in its goals around the region, including the security of Israel, but also in prosecuting the war in Iraq and in other areas. And so this group was more enthusiastic about bringing kind of democracy to the forefront of U.S. public diplomacy and putting pressure on Mubarak about democracy as a way to get him to make concessions on strategic cooperation.
You mentioned after the fall of Mubarak that the Obama administration declared a pro-democracy policy, but that in fact, as you say, this new chapter in American diplomacy was actually old priorities repackaged. Could you talk about why you feel that is?
Yeah, so the Obama administration's, let's talk about first the Obama administration's response to the Egyptian uprising. A few weeks ago, which is to say, I think in late September 2012, there was a New York Times article, front page New York Times article, and then it continued for a full page and inside the A section, about how Obama responded to the Egyptian uprising that began on January 25th, 2011. And the basic story of the article was that Obama struggled with responding to this threat to Hosni Mubarak, a longtime American ally. But after a lot of soul searching, Obama decided that Mubarak had to resign. And so he had a phone call with Mubarak. It was his second and last phone call to Mubarak during the 18-day uprising, in which he said, there must be an orderly transition, and it must begin now. And the way the New York Times reported it was by saying that an orderly transition must begin now, he was basically telling Mubarak, you must resign. We know from a lot of other reporting, some of which I cite in my book, that actually Obama was not keen on seeing Mubarak resign. That could have led to even more chaos in Egypt, and certainly the Obama administration did not want to see the U.S. lose this crucial ally in the region. But they wanted to, they wanted an exit strategy, some way to pull Egypt out of this crisis while retaining the U.S.-Egyptian alliance. And the idea they came up with was an orderly transition, a phrase that Obama and Clinton used on several occasions. And this orderly transition was going to be a way to make, to bring Mubarak from the foreground into kind of the background, and for him to cede his powers to his intelligence chief, who had just been appointed vice president, Omar Suleiman. Now, Omar Suleiman was probably the most popular Egyptian political figure for Washington, D.C. He had been the intelligence chief for nearly two decades. He was the Cairo's point man on the Extraordinary Rendition Program. He was had very good relations with Israel as well. And he would have been an ideal successor for those in Washington in terms of somebody to come after Mubarak who could have continued Mubarak's policies and perhaps even when it came to foreign policy and national security issues, pursued them more effectively than Mubarak had. So the idea was for Mubarak to recede into the background and for Omar Suleiman to become de facto president, at least until new elections could be held in September of 2011, which is when they were scheduled, and then Omar Suleiman could become actual president. So that was the plan. It was derailed because the protests continued. The activists didn't leave Tahrir Square. They didn't go home, although Omar Suleiman told them to go home. The defense minister, who was later acting president, Hussein Tantawi, also told them to go home. They didn't go home. They stayed. And eventually, the military took over. Now, when the military, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, forced Mubarak to relinquish power on February 11th, 2011, Obama hailed this decision as a victory of the Egyptian people. Publicly, he embraced the outcome. And over subsequent months, Obama and Hillary Clinton have talked a lot about supporting a democratic transition in Egypt, supporting a transition to civilian rule in Egypt. They've expressed support for free and fair elections. And what's happened here is that after proactively supporting authoritarianism for decades, the U.S. has reactively accepted the beginnings of democracy in Egypt. And it has sort of done it reluctantly. I mean, basically, we wouldn't be where we are today if it weren't for Egyptian protesters putting so much pressure on the Egyptian government and indirectly on the American government to change its position. So there has been an evolution in the relationship, but I would continue to say that the rhetoric coming from Washington should be measured against the behavior. You know, it's fine to say that the United States supports free and fair elections and supports a democratic transition. In terms of the actions of the Obama administration, we did not see a substantial change from Hosni Mubarak to the period in which the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces was running the country, which was about for 18 months. And by when I say that we didn't see a substantial change, I mean that we actually just continued to see support for authoritarianism. It was just a new kind of authoritarianism. It was kind of military stewardship instead of Hosni Mubarak being president. But when the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces repressed people, when it put activists on military trials, when it had army vehicles running over protesters in October of 2011, killing 20-some protesters, when there was a second kind of small uprising and a series of battles in Tahrir Square again in fall of 2011, the Obama administration did not cut off military aid. It didn't use any of its significant levers upon the Egyptian regime to try to reduce that repression and stop it. So there's been this kind of posture of, well, sort of, we're not involved. This is for Egyptians to decide. But at the same time, the U.S. is continuing to support the Egyptian military with tremendous aid. And rather than kind of proactively helping to empower and to strengthen civilian forces. And one way that the U.S. could do that, which is something that Egyptians are calling for, would be to forgive the significant debt that Egypt accumulated during the Mubarak years, debt to the United States, which would give a tremendous economic boost and could help the elected civilian government have a lot more budgetary and discretionary power to operate, instead of continuing to operate in the shadow of the Egyptian military.
What do you think the lasting legacy will be of U.S. support, their history of support of Sadat, of Mubarak, and also of their actions during the transition period that Egypt has been going through over the past couple years?
Well, I think the legacy is politically within Egypt, it's a legacy of devastation. I mean, there's just going to take years to build a strong civil society. It's going to take years to build up vibrant political parties and to establish strong traditions of free and fair elections. Now, so far this year, there have been a lot of hopeful signs about a change from authoritarianism to civilian-led democracy. The elections, which were monitored by the Carter Center, and I actually happened to be there when they were as one of the observers, the presidential elections this spring and the runoff in June, went very well. And then subsequently, elected President Mohamed Morsi sidelined the military in a very bold and surprising move. And that's a hopeful sign for improving the power of elected officials over unelected generals. But there's still a long way to go. We'll have to see what happens with the new constitution, with the next set of elections, and we'll have to see how much the military is willing to accept civilian rule. The legacy right now is one of great uncertainty, because there is this risk of what you might call authoritarian recidivism, basically relapsing back into authoritarianism after some promising elections and some initial progress toward democracy. I think also a major legacy left by the U.S.-Egyptian alliance during the Sadat and Mubarak years is a vast internal security apparatus, which is going to have to be gradually dismantled. You're going to have to, these employees, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of employees who were basically serving authoritarianism and working as informants or worse than that, you know, torturers. And they're going to have to be shifted into other sectors, into some other kinds of employment. Their victims may also want justice at some point, some type of truth and reconciliation commission could be needed. So the legacies of authoritarianism are bleak. I think that Egyptians have made great strides during the last nearly 2 years at beginning to erase some of them. But I think in the future, those who in Washington who are interested in really, you know, improving and strengthening democracy in Egypt should think more deeply about what it will mean to stop participating in authoritarianism in Egypt. For the U.S. and its policies to undergo a transformation, at least on the order of what Egyptians have been able to accomplish.
Back in September, President Obama, in an interview, said that Egypt is neither an enemy nor an ally. It's a quote that obviously people in the administration tried to walk back rather quickly. But what do you see as the short-term and more longer-term future of the U.S. relationship with Egypt under Mohamed Morsi?
Yes. Yeah, that was an interesting quote. You know, the State Department responded in a very technical sense to assert that Egypt is an ally because on the books, you know, in American law, there's a list of countries that are called not major non-NATO allies. And Egypt is on that list, and it's been on that list since the 1980s. And being a major non-NATO ally just basically means the U.S. gets to sell that country weapons and vehicles that it otherwise might not be able to receive. So really, it's a term that does not necessarily reflect high levels of strategic cooperation. I would say beyond the technical term that Egypt in practice is absolutely a key ally. During 2001 to 2005, when the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan were going on, Egypt was giving the U.S. military an average of 20 overflight permissions a day for U.S. vehicles to pass through Egyptian airspace. In addition to that, Egypt provides U.S. Navy vessels, including nuclear-powered battleships, the ability to go through the Suez Canal at an expedited rate. Essentially, they can jump to the head of the line, and they can avoid cumbersome inspections that would slow them down. And then there's the tremendous amounts of intelligence cooperation that go on between Egypt and the U.S. When the U.S. wants to know about al-Qaeda, Egypt has been one of its chief partners in trying to collect information and intelligence. So there are all kinds of ways in which they're allies. I think what was interesting about that quote that President Obama gave, obviously he's in the middle of a campaign, which has become even more competitive in recent weeks. And I think because of the demonstrations in Cairo, he didn't want to just say, well, oh yeah, Egypt's an ally, because he was very disappointed in the response of Mohamed Morsi to the protests and the kind of it's sort of the mobbing I should say of the U.S. embassy, because Morsi initially spoke out against the YouTube video Innocence of Islam rather than speaking out against the rioters, but what he was really saying there, what Obama was saying, is not that Egypt wasn't an ally, but he was saying, at the moment, it feels like Mohamed Morsi isn't an ally. And I think it was interesting then, the sort of sequel to that that quote or that interaction between Morsi and Obama over the riots in Cairo was Mohamed Morsi's visit to New York and his speech before the United Nations, which was marked a new page in U.S.-Egyptian relations, because you begin to see what an Egyptian foreign policy that reflects Egyptian public opinion could look like. I mean, we've had the public opinion polling data from Egypt and other Arab countries for years. We know that when you poll them, Arabs in the region will say that they don't think Iran is a threat. They think Israel and the United States are the biggest threats. They think that the U.S. is motivated by concerns about oil. And they don't think the U.S. is seriously pursuing Arab-Israeli peace. So they'll say all these things. They believe them. There's a lot of empirical evidence to back them up. And now those opinions are going to be reflected in top-level policymaking by people like Mohamed Morsi and other elected Egyptian politicians and other elected Arab politicians in other countries. So you begin to see that we could have a relationship, the United States could have a relationship with Egypt, a little more like the U.S. relationship with Turkey, where there are agreements 90% of the time, but disagreements 10% of the time. And I think that's what Obama and the White House and Congress, when it's back in session and dealing with foreign policy, will be coping with. Like, what does it mean to deal with Egypt as an independent country that's an ally, but that it has its own ideas? What does it mean for American politicians to think of Egyptian politicians not as just cronies of Mubarak who can be pushed around, but as public servants who are representing the ideas of Egyptians? And I think there's going to be an adjustment period, and there are going to be some difficult conversations between Egyptians and Americans, and I hope among Americans, because for decades, the United States has been able to take Egypt for granted. It's been able to assume that because there is an autocrat in charge who is dependent on the United States for support, that Egypt will do whatever the United States wants. And now the U.S. is having to cope with the fact that Egypt is a sovereign country. Egyptians have their own ideas, and they feel that their foreign policy has not served their country's interests very well under the prior presidents. And they want a relationship of reciprocity with the United States and of mutual respect.
Well, Jason, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. Before I let you go, could you talk briefly about any projects you're currently working on?
Glad to. I'm currently beginning to look at the relationship between U.S. companies, oil companies, as well as weapons manufacturers, at their relationship with regimes in the Middle East and how that played out during the Arab uprisings. So you could say that in terms of building on what I did in democracy prevention, I'm now going to try to look at the money underneath the strategic interests. So the ways in which the U.S. Is driven by American companies and domestic constituencies to get involved in the to get involved and remain involved in the Middle East.
That sounds very interesting, and hopefully I'll get a chance to chat with you again when that's completed.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. Well, thank you again for taking the time today.
Hey, thank you.
Take care. Thank you for listening to another episode of New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. And thanks again to Jason Brownlee for taking the time to talk about his new book, Democracy Prevention: The Politics of the U.S.-Egyptian Alliance. You can follow New Books in Middle Eastern Studies on Twitter, where we are at New Books Mideast, and also on Facebook, as well as through our website, newbooksinmiddleeasternstudies.com, where you can find links to our show. To send me your comments or to suggest an author or book for a future show, you can use the contact information on our website. Also, if you enjoy the shows, please consider taking a moment to rate or review them on iTunes, which will help more people find our shows. Thank you for listening.